Welcome to this episode of SCIF Meetings Podcast, the podcast for curious event professionals embracing the future of business events. My name is Andrea Doyle, and I am the executive editor of SCIF Meetings. In this episode entitled Building Human Connections and Communities, I have the pleasure of chatting with Greg Tolley, the Chief Executive Officer of Tolley Management Group. We talk about subjects including how he grew up in the industry, the value and impact of business events, how it's important that the industry come together to speak with one voice globally, how AI is forcing companies to define why they exist, the importance of data mining to understand audiences and what they want, why he is a big proponent of a global pricing strategy, and his passion for social impact and advocacy. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did, and I invite you to check out other episodes of the SCIF Meetings podcast with tips and insight from today's most influential event professionals. You can find all the episodes on our website or subscribe through your favorite podcast service.
Now for a word from our sponsors, PHL Life Sciences, a division of the Philadelphia Convention and Visitors Bureau. Host your convention or trade show in Philadelphia, one of America's leading life sciences hubs. PHL Life Sciences, the first and only CVB division of its kind, will connect you to the professionals at the forefront of your industry and to a culture you can only find in Philadelphia, a city known for its rich history that's forging a bright future. Philadelphia challenges the expected and defies convention. A world of discovery is waiting. Visit phllife.com to learn more.
If you would just want to introduce yourself, that would be fabulous.
Good day, everybody. I'm Greg Tolley, CEO of Tolley Management Group, and we're an association and event management firm that works with U.S. national global associations and also have an affiliated association event management firm based in Africa in Kenya.
And you're an event planner as well, isn't that
correct? Yes, absolutely.
Can you start by telling us about your journey as an event professional? And it would be great if you could start when you first encountered business events and take us to your current role today.
Sure. Yeah, it's funny because we always talk about in our industry how people kind of fell into it or how did you find it? And I actually followed my father who fell into it. So he was a 25-year employee of Mobil Oil and then got a call out of the blue from a high school colleague who at the time was publishing major medical journals based here in southern New Jersey. And the volunteers kept asking for him to take on more and more of the management of their associations. And so he started one of the early association management companies back in the 70s and had asked my father to come in and take over and run the association management division. And so my father started that in 1975. And so his day was our dinner table conversation. So I started to get fairly early some idea of what managing associations, and because they were major medical associations, they were also managing their meetings. So what managing major business events, in this case, most in the healthcare space, were all about, and the challenges and the frustrations, yet the validation that comes, as we know, from bringing any group of people together for what they're trying to achieve. So that was my high school years. Then college, I was in Washington, D.C. At the time, that company was the largest medical association management company now, and they were the largest customer for the old Sheraton Washington Hotel, which was close to my school campus. So whenever they were in, I was over there running the floor, running signs, working registration, the exhibit floor. And then the owner of the company would often come down to these major events, and he would take the Pearl Mesta suite. For those of us that remember those days and the great suite in the Sheraton Washington Hotel. And in the evening, he'd gather the whole staff. The hotel would wheel in carts of Dom Perignon champagne. So for a college kid, it was like, what's not to like about this industry? So that's really where I got my first taste of it. And then my first job in the industry was with the Baltimore Convention Bureau, marketing the city of Baltimore as a business event destination. And primarily at that time, because of Johns Hopkins and everything else, we were my role was to bring in major medical meetings to the city of Baltimore, because that's where my experience was in working with Slack. So went from there to then joining my father at the Association Management Company, an event management company that he worked for, which at the time was called Slack Incorporated. And 2 years later, we said, we think we can do this a different way. And we left and started our own company. And that was back in 1987. So I've been doing that ever since. So about 40 some odd years, even more if you include my college career in understanding business events and association management.
So you've watched the industry evolve through all these years.
Truly, literally from the napkin stage of contracts to where we are now. Right. And to a very small, I would say, relatively unsophisticated industry doing major events, relying on personal contacts and relationships, to now something that's vastly different, much larger, but different in every way.
Did you envision it becoming what it is today?
I think the good side of it, yes, seeing an ever increasing realization of the value of these meetings, particularly when you look across, right, globally, when you look at the value of business events. I think we saw it then, but I think most of us didn't quite realize even then what the industry was and the power of the industry. And I think that's what's come alive. So I think that's all on the positive side. And then building up a legitimate whole value chain to support what we do, to make it a huge industry. It's been well documented by EIC and around the globe for what it represents in terms of both direct and indirect benefit to countries and destinations. So I think that's been really great to watch that grow and that realization sink in. I think on the challenging side, I think, you know, the legalization of our industry, certainly the transactional monetization of our industry, I think has all become a little more problematic in terms of both on the legal side, who's responsible and who's liable for what. And we're now running into 25-page contracts routinely for a small meeting to the bigger issues around, does the business model still work? And how different is the business model all around the globe, depending on where you're doing business. So it's really interesting. And that's one of the best things I love about doing this globally is there's the US model, European model, rest of world model that's as different in Africa as it is in Malaysia.
Do you feel that the industry still needs work as far as getting the message out as to how important it is and how much it injects into the economy?
Totally. I have been frustrated for probably most of my professional career that we really haven't yet come together as an industry to speak with one voice. Our terminology is still all over the place around the globe, and I recognize that's a tough nut to crack. But, you know, mice is still very prevalent in parts of the world, and people don't understand what that means. We haven't all agreed on even the business events term globally. So I think we've lost, or we have not yet found a way to speak with one voice globally about the value of the business events industry. And I think that's a shame. And I think our industry association should do a better job at that. I think EIC has come a long way with doing the calculator and the speaking about the value of business events and actually measuring the value of business events in countries and setting up that model, which I think has given us the basis to be able to speak a little more authoritatively about what our industry represents. But as you and I both know, it's the dialogue around the iceberg, which is another organization that's done a good job internationally talking about the business case. There's so much more below the surface, like an iceberg, to what the value of business events bring to a destination. Than just the economics. And we tend to just talk economics, and that's not where the real value lies.
So how can we get that message out there?
I think part of it is, you know, it's tough to talk about what you can't measure. And those things that are below the surface, the knowledge transfer, I don't know how anybody would figure out, how do we measure that knowledge transfer? How do we measure the impact of bringing global leaders in XYZ industry into a destination? And over time, the results of those business connections, the inbound investment that's made, everything that happens. we haven't yet been able to really measure that. How do we measure taking a, within that same industry, national experts that have now enlarged their network to the global experts and become part of a bigger industry? How do you measure that? So I think we really need to turn our academic communities loose on this and say, give us a model. Do some research about how we could measure some of this, because I think once we can, we intuitively know it. We have case studies that show it, but we haven't really measured it. And I think until we can marry that measurement with the quantitative economic measurement, then we've got the story and the data to prove it. Because right now we're kind of left kind of pointing to destinations and how they've used business events to do exactly what they want to want, grow sectors, grow their entire economies based around business events. And that's really what Singapore and, you could argue, Australia and particularly the main Australian cities have been wildly successful at. Convincing their policy leaders about the full value of business events and then bringing those global events to their shores and fighting above their weight in the industries that they want to grow in.
So in order to be respected, do you feel this is an initiative that's going to have to get more power behind it?
I think it should. In other words, we're already respected on the sheer economics because we can prove what that represents. And I think they said our whole global industry, we'd be like the 13th or 14th biggest nation based on the value of the global trade, if you will, in business events. But there's so much more beneath that, but we can't quantify it because we haven't been able to measure it.
Okay. Yep. And it's just so important.
Yeah. Yep.
Switching gears for a minute, was interested in finding out what event you've organized that you're most proud of.
Yeah, I am incredibly fortunate to have had one client for almost my entire professional life in doing business events, and that's the International Convention for Alcoholics Anonymous. And it happens once every 5 years. It's around 50 to 60,000 attendees, and I am in the process of doing my 8th event for them in Vancouver in 2025. So I have done this literally had them pick them up as a client in 1985. 1990 was my first one, and I've done them every 5 years since. And it has been remarkably rewarding to serve the fellowship, but also by doing an event of that size and scale, we're really testing the limits of destinations. And where it's a great exercise to plan and stretch and teach people how to do something of that size and scale. So I've been very, very fortunate, and that's my signature.
And this is held globally.
It is only North America. So this particular client only operates in Canada and the U.S. AA operates globally, but it's a very decentralized model. So for this big event, it's only it's put on by the North American Alcoholics Anonymous. And we invite people from 100 countries and they come as part of that 50,000 people.
How many months in advance do you start working on that?
Pretty much. Well, we're always running kind of three at a time because we have to plan that far in advance to get our site, get all the contracts set into place. So we just finished site selection for 2035 event. Yeah, but we know where we are in 2030. We're already, those contracts are in process and going. And then we literally start about 3.5 years prior to the event in terms of the actual, that event planning cycle.
And you said Vancouver is next. What are some past destinations you've met in?
Past destinations, let me see. It was San Diego, Seattle, Minneapolis, Toronto, San Antonio, Atlanta, Detroit, and now Vancouver.
Wow, a wide array of different cities.
Yes. So that's been my best for kind of in the U.S. and Canada. And then I've had the good fortune of managing events, as I mentioned, around the globe. And probably most interesting to me is by virtue of opening up in Africa, managing events in Africa and just really seeing it from a completely different size, scope, resource, availability, and all other set of challenges.
Why Africa in particular? I know it holds a special place in your heart.
It does. So first, my partner's African, but I've always been drawn to Africa, even a little kid. I think something about the complete and utter differenceness of it, but also by the fact that that's from whence we all came. So I always felt this attraction and then had the opportunity to really actionize it. And it's just been wonderful.
And you have an association management company in Africa, in Kenya?
Exactly right. Yes, based in Nairobi. So it was both association management and event management. So it mirrors what we do out of our company here in the United States.
And do you plan events there for multinational corporations?
Generally, we stay in our association lane. That's where I've primarily been. My entire career has been in nonprofits and doing their events. And so that's the basis there. Like anybody else, we'll kind of work with anything else that that comes and is interested. But for instance, the World Potato Congress is coming to Kenya in 26. So it's a global gathering of everybody who's involved in the exactly planting, growth, manufacture of potato and potato-based products. There truly is a meeting for everything.
You consult with nations and local destinations on developing business event strategies and destination management organizations. Can you explain?
Yeah, so it's been a bit of a, I guess, a sideline. Along the way, like many of us, we've been asked to work with and participate in customer advisory boards for destination management organizations. That kind of got me a little more focused on that side, and then really started to find myself being asked to participate, say, in the Destination Next Future Study, to really start understanding what are the issues that DMOs are facing around the globe in terms of their challenges of both advocacy within their own governments, as well as just kind of developing their destinations to be able to receive and bid for inbound international meetings. And that has progressed to some opportunities to consult directly with destinations and nations in setting up national DMOs and helping both those national DMOs and other, say, city or province DMOs just develop a business event strategy. So it's been a fascinating way to kind of bring what I do every day into the other side of the industry. And help them build out a strategy for attracting business events to their destinations.
Well, that's great.
It's fun. I get to kind of see all parts of it and also be able to work around the world doing that.
So, like you said, you've been in the events industry for decades. Is there anything of late that has really impressed you?
So I do think COVID, for all of its downside and what it represented in the lives that it completely destroyed and upended, for our industry, I think it became a bit of a defining moment on both the plus side and the negatives. We saw the negatives, but the important thing was I think everybody saw the negatives, and that was everybody from policy leaders to heads of state to mayors to the people that we needed and continue to need to understand not just the value economically, but the value of how we everything this industry represents. So I think that was a real opportunity to show this is what happens when it all goes away. And not just tourism, but when you take business events completely out of the equation. So I think that allowed us to almost reset some of the discussion about who we are, why we're important, and why we kind of need and should be at the table when we're talking about economic development. When we're talking about decisions that impact the free flow of people and goods around the world, to kind of consider what it is we actually do and what we bring.
How do you see the events industry changing in the next 5 years?
So I think the issues around AI, as I've said in a couple of circumstances, I think are an existential threat to associations and therefore association events, unless we kind of get ahead of it. And start actively engaging in it from an event planning standpoint, but also from a content standpoint, I think is the bigger risk for associations. It's been coming at us, right? If the internet is it kept going, you can get anything, anywhere, anytime. And now something even bigger can answer my question, put things into context in a way that associations used to claim we're the only ones who can do that. We're scanning, we're looking at all the things that are impacting us, and we're creating what we think are the priorities that you need to be focused on and be dealing with. Well, now we've got the ability to do that with me sitting in front of my computer in about 5 minutes. And I think that represents a real risk for us to come back and redefine, why do we exist as an organization? What else do we need to be doing and should we be doing in light of this world and these changes to, again, prove our value to our stakeholders, whoever they may be? And from an event standpoint, I think it really comes down to, how is my event going to be the must-attend event in the industry, in the sector, in the space? And I think prior to COVID, you know, we were going kind of fat, dumb, and happy. We had a lot of events in any given sector, in any given space, and a lot of us attended a lot of events. And coming out of COVID, I heard immediately out of that and subsequently, so now 3 years out, people saying, yeah, I'm not doing as many events. I don't have to, or I don't want to, or it's too difficult because of the travel, because of everything that's in our world right now. So that means people are not going to as many events in their sector, whatever that may be. They're making choices. And if they're making choices, how do we as event owners and event planners make sure one of those choices is mine, my event? And I've been surprised, given that, that we haven't seen, I think, a more focus on intentional event redesign to really drill down on what's going to ensure that my event is the event they're going to come to no matter what. And I think that's for a variety of reasons. I think, you know, we're all creatures of habit. We came back. Yes, we maybe need to make a little tweak over here, a little tweak over here, but otherwise, let's just come back to what we were doing. And I think we're missing, A, the generational issues, what our next audience, our next member, or our next stakeholder is going to want. So I'm not sure we're actually mining that and being really clear on understanding what their needs and wants are as it relates to events. I think we're kind of missing, and this is regionalized around the globe, the importance of sustainability, some key things to that next audience group that should impact what we're doing. I think we're kind of missing the ability to separate out what's information we should be delivering, but doesn't have to be in this setting. And let's figure out where, how else we can deliver that versus, no, what's the uniqueness of getting these people together in this space and time face-to-face that we should be doubling and tripling down on in terms of what can I hear? What dialogue can I hear? What can you bring together to make me think about what it is we're doing in a completely different way? And we have the unique ability to do that when we bring people face to face. But I'm not sure I'm seeing a lot of groups be really intentional about redesigning that and unpacking. Because the other thing we continue to hear from every audience is, my brain just can't stay engaged from 7 in the morning until 9 a.m. Cannot do it. But I don't see anybody creating those white spaces. I see very few groups kind of opening up their meetings to allow for kind of either engineered networking or just plain free space and time for people to digest and connect in however they choose to do that. I think that puts us at risk. We know number one and number two, the reason people come, education and networking. Everything has said that forever. Yet we have program committees and event owners who think they have to cram it all in there at them. And what the neurologists keep telling us and neuroscientists, our brain doesn't work that way. Right. We can't do it. And it's just fascinating to me, and even in science and medicine, which we still, most of our meetings are in, they're just not willing to change how they present and feel they have to present from morning till nighttime. It's crazy.
And it's interesting you say that, because survey after survey comes in and says networking is the number one reason we attend events, but it doesn't seem that there's any specific networking. It's just right. Kind of like, here's a cocktail reception, go at it. And that's not the easiest way to network.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, clearly there are some groups that are trying to do what a term I'm hearing is kind of engineered networking, where we're really creating this intentional remix of the group as many times as we can, right, throughout the event. So, you know, it's going to be geographic. It's going to be by sector within whatever your industry is, or which side of the industry you're on. It's going to be by, you know, whether you like cats, you like dogs. There's so many different ways we can do it to spark people connecting in ways that could accommodate even those people who are not comfortable in those situations.
Yeah. And also, just you talked about generations, and it, again, studies show that the new generation are going to be even more picky as to what events they attend. They're not going to attend an event just to attend an event.
Exactly right. And so this is where I think, as I mentioned, I think we're not the event owners, whether it's the association or whoever owns the event, we're not doing enough data mining to really understand our audience and what it is they want, and getting down to the nitty gritty of that. You know, what's the topics? What's the type of presentation style? What's their ideal mix between education and networking? What would they like to see in networking? What's critical to them? And I just don't think we're paying as much attention to that and then acting on it as we should.
Are you ready to celebrate your successes in the world of meetings and events? The Skift Meetings Awards are back for 2024, recognizing the most innovative business events companies across 15 categories, and we want you to be a part of it. Winners will feature on Skift Meetings, sending a clear signal to events professionals around the world that these are partners they can rely on. The final deadline for submissions is June 11th. We encourage you to start your submission today to secure the best entry rates. For more information and to start your submission, head to live.skift.com.
Because like you said, the same old isn't.
Yeah. And to your point, they're telling us that loud and clear. Right. And that is maybe bringing in more technology. That is doing things different. And I just don't see the focus change on that, which means we as owners are not making the appropriate case to leadership about the risks of not doing it, or about why we need to be doing different things, or why we need to take this sacred cow portion of the event and push it to on demand because it just isn't bringing people in. So I think there's all those sorts of things that we have to do a better job. And if we have the data, then we can build a better case to go to leadership and say, we have to change this event.
And like you touched upon the pandemic, we learned during the pandemic, we can get education virtually.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think that's the other piece of this that has worried me, is that one of the things the pandemic did when we did all go virtual was it allowed some voices and some people at the table that didn't otherwise get a chance to be at the table because they were too low on the totem pole to get budget to travel, or because they were from parts of the world that simply couldn't afford to travel or couldn't get the access to travel. And then we all have gone back to what it was, and we've lost some of that. And I worry that, you know, that was creating a kind of more level playing field, particularly again for underserved communities in whatever industry and space it is. And I'm not sure that that has maintained where we had gotten to since we snapped back. And I think that still creates an opportunity for organizations to think about how do we do that. And I think the unfortunate part, I've heard some colleagues say, yeah, we didn't see those members convert, or those people convert to membership or to attendance when we came back. And you're like, well, I get that, but have you delved into the why? You know, do you have a global pricing model? How are you handling the selection process? All those same sorts of things. And the conversations I've had, they haven't gone that deep into it because they just assumed those people were going to come. If they tasted it online, they would come face to face. Well, there are still barriers there. And what have you done to understand those barriers and address those barriers if that's important to you?
Right. And help them eliminate those barriers to meet.
Right. Right. Or if it's not important, have you made a decision, a policy decision that's not important? Meaning, has there been a conversation to say, yeah, we realize by not having a global pricing strategy, we are Xing 2/3 of the world out of the ability to participate.
Do you feel a global pricing strategy is important?
I do. I do. I'm being in Africa, and kind of for years traveling through the global South, I think this is going to be one of the defining issues going forward for us, is how do we better integrate the global South and the global North? It's happening in ways people don't like, because they're marching north, literally. And if we don't kind of get our arms around this, I think, and help those societies build and engage where they are, they're going to keep doing what you or I would do for our families under the same circumstances. Not safe, can't get a job, can't feed my kids, I'm going where I can. And we would do the exact same thing. So I think we've all got to get a little more invested in saying, how do we support the rest of the world come up to a level where they don't need to come north? And not because and let me just also be clear, not because I don't want them. I am all for the globe coming together as we were starting to see before the pandemic and before some of the other regionalized and global conflicts have come. I get concerned that we have seen the high point of that globe coming together that we saw prior to the pandemic, when you could have fully global meetings with all of the globe represented. And I think we're seeing that fracture back apart again. And I'm not sure we get that back.
What would it take to get it back?
I think we've passed that point because of the way the geopolitics is starting to work. I think you're going to have a real tough time getting that back to the table, because we're really drawing some pretty clear lines globally for those geopolitics, and it's going to be problematic. Associations used to be able to kind of slide under the radar and, oh no, we're going to bring, you know, we can still do it. But we've heard some things out of parts of the world where we could see governments saying, no, you're not going to participate because you're essentially sharing technology or sharing what may be the next technology. And we don't want you to do that. Yeah. Huh. Plus, look at our challenges with immigration. Look at our challenges with visas for people to come. And that challenge is only getting worse. And we're seeing it everywhere. It's a problem within Africa. And they, you know, Africans keep saying, what are we doing to ourselves? We're creating barriers for us to even do business with each other here on the continent, let alone go north. So it's not just a problem between north and south, but even within areas of the south where, again, for many of the same reasons, we're creating these barriers. But that's limiting the growth, it's limiting the integration, it's limiting people's ability to live.
If you could change one thing in the events industry, what would it be?
Wow. So one of the conversations we had during the pandemic, there was a whole lot of talk about the business models need to change because who was paying for what seemed to be out of whack. Meaning, in one just example, certainly here in North America, we kind of load a lot of costs onto the exhibitors, and that gets us free stuff from our decorators. And then we have this model, ongoing business model of contracted room nights determines how much free space we might get. Yet our very process of what's happening with how people decide where they want to stay is not necessarily in contracted hotels anymore. And yet that model still determines how a city may judge my piece of business and what benefits I may get for them. None of that's changing. And yet all the inputs are changing, right? We're hearing people, I'm going to stay in Airbnb. I am not staying in that convention hotel. It's not how I want to spend 5 days in the city. That business model isn't changing. The business model of load up the exhibitors and, you know, I want that free entry booth. I want all the stuff I want for free from my decorator isn't changing. So there was talk, but I haven't seen anything. So I think one of my wishes would be a real dialogue around kind of unpacking the business model and saying, is there a better way to do this that's more equitable across the board for what people should be paying to participate? That's one.
So if you were to plan an event for 100 Gregs, what would that event look like?
That's a scary thought on many levels, not just to me, but I'm sure to anyone else who knows me. But I think we're, you know, we're this marriage. And one of the things that making my event most important has also brought back to the table is the value of the destination experience. We'd gotten to a point, I think, prior to the pandemic where it was kind of content is king. No matter where we go, we can move this meeting all over. People are going to come because of the content. And I think what we've kind of learned coming back out of the pandemic and realizing people do want something different. And if I'm going to make my meeting be really important and bring that uniqueness, that authenticity to it, the destination plays a really big role. So I think that's kind of put a spotlight back on making a decision that does both. How do we challenge a destination to contribute and help us build the best experience possible in their destination now becomes part of that site selection process rather than just dates, rates, and space. A, that gets you to a different strategic conversation. B, it also allows us, if we do it right, to tap into resources that are in that destination that absolutely would make my event better, make it more interesting, make it more interactive, make it something that would truly bring that great content that's unique to being face-to-face with this group of stakeholders and a destination experience that just aids and magnifies this incredible networking opportunity, education opportunity, and hopefully learning and impact on the destination itself. That now starts to make everybody and 100 me's feel really good about taking my time and investing it there and getting the most out of it.
Have you attended an event recently that got it right, that really impressed you?
Boy, trying to think recently. Can't say that I have. Which is a little problematic, I recognize.
For all the reasons we just chatted about, I guess.
Right. Yep. You know, I think some of our industry events are trying and doing some interesting things. I think trying to look outside the box when it comes to sponsorship and calling it activations or things like that, but that are allowing a little more creativity and a little more areas of interest outside that session room when you don't want to be in that session any longer. So I'm seeing some things. The idea of festivalization of events, which is kind of what that comes under, I think makes a whole lot of sense because all of our brains work differently. And if I can create a space that's going to be different from these other spaces, the people whose brains work that way are going to gravitate there. And now I'm going to have a different conversation with somebody I just met looking or interacting in that space or with that thing than I would have if we were just sitting together in the conference room listening to a session. So I think that idea is, I think more folks are starting to understand that.
So I guess similar, we were reacquainted once again in DC last week during Business Events Industry Week at ASAE. And I thought it was interesting the way a big focus was going to tables and having discussions as attendees.
Yes.
Instead of just sitting and listening to people speak.
Exactly. We've got it. The interaction part is so key to this. And I think that's also part about how you build out space and design to enable that sort of thing to happen more. Because that opportunity lets me hear from a whole lot of different people on a subject I might be interested in. And then again, that connection. And that's what these events are about. Right. You know, our mission is building human connections and communities. And I think that's what associations are for and what our events are for. But we got to come back to say, how do we do that? How do we optimize that for everybody as opposed to just what we've been doing one way for so long?
And has that been a mantra of your career, building human connection and community?
It has. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and I think through that's the unique thing about our industry is it does that. In its finest form, it does that.
Right. And is that
when you do that, when you think about that north-south, when you think about, you know, within a country, who you can bring to the table, we know we can do that.
Right. Which makes it so special. I mean.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's part of what, you know, I think, as we also know, the next generation wants to have an impact. They just don't want a job. They want something that they can kind of invest in. And I think that's, again, what I think associations really can offer. And it's what we've been able to offer our employees and talk about routinely. What we do makes better doctors. That makes for better outcomes. That improves patient lives. That improves global health if we're doing that on a global level. That's, I think, powerful stuff.
Right. It's the ripple effect.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that can apply to better engineers, better, you pick it, right? It's all there. That's part of what we're doing.
Better potato growers.
There you go.
We like to touch upon leadership a bit in our podcast. So I was hoping you could tell me what are the key qualities or skills that have enabled you to be successful?
Great question. I think curiosity, number one, because that's enabled me to really look and cast a wide net as to what's happening, what might be of interest to my company, what could I bring in, what can I learn then from that curiosity that I can bring in and make us a better company. And I came from, my father, as I said, was mobile oil company back in the 60s. So we're talking highly regimented, tie every day, very formal hierarchical structure. And, you know, I kind of looked at that and that's the way we started the company. But I said, that's not how this can be going forward. A, it's not me. B, I don't think it's where our next generations are going to go. And that led me to do some more reading and listening to people, kind of the idea of conscious capitalism. The idea there's got to be something more to what we're doing here than just to benefit the owners, or what's the point? And that kind of led to us becoming an ESOP, employee stock ownership company, because it was like, well, yeah, that just makes sense, because why shouldn't they own a piece of it if I want them as invested as I am in what we're trying to do together? I absolutely want them to feel that and have that. And that then started to kind of this drive to change culture and really put our people first no matter what. And how we talk about what we do, having them be owners in the company, I think has demonstrated some leadership and then applied it to enable us to become what we are now. So that translates to, I think, people that are more invested in what we do every day for the benefit of our clients, because they know we're taking care of them in every way, in terms of very flexible policies. We were running the first during the pandemic. Okay, that's it. We're all going virtual, and I see no benefit to bringing everyone back, because they get the flexibility in their lives to work the way they want to work. And we're seeing that pay back in employee loyalty. And in how they continue to serve our clients so well. So I think all of that goes in there. There's probably a bunch of other terms that along the way fell into that, but it really has been a journey that I've taken. But I think it really is being open, being curious, being willing to constantly learn, and then the accountability to actually do stuff. Because we can all learn a lot of stuff and not do a darn thing, implement anything, and then you haven't moved at all. But by implementing it, we can then measure it and see what the changes are and keep going.
How many employees do you have?
We're up to 75 now, which is the most we've ever been. So we're growing about 20% a year. So,
and 100% virtual?
We are. I'm in the office. There are like three of us that are in every day. I'm in some portion every day, but everybody else is spread all over the globe. And yeah, work virtually 100%.
Do you get your employees together throughout the year?
We do. So part of that now, that whole culture aspect is really taking, okay, so I'm not paying rent and some of the other things from an overhead standpoint that we would have before, but investing that fully into how do we kind of build out that culture, maintain that connection, bring everybody together at least twice a year. And I mean, everybody. And one of those we're flying in the spouses as well, so that we're intentionally figuring out how to nurture and grow and develop those connection points while maintaining the rest of the culture. Why are we here doing what we're doing together? So really being hyper focused on it.
Great. What people or organizations have you learned from or partnered with that have been key in your career?
Wow. So many. And I think so many of my generation, we really did have mentors and folks that we knew who brought us along the way. And that's what got me involved very early in my career into PCMA, and really learned you get so much more when you volunteer and give your time to an organization. And that certainly worked in my case because I got involved probably in my 20s and was a volunteer engaged all the way along. And that eventually made me president of PCMA nationally and then of the foundation. And all of those give you leadership opportunities. All of those give you a network that you then use and build from, which I've been able to do. I've then been actively engaged in ASAE, actively engaged in ICA, the International Congress and Convention Association, where I was on their board. So that engagement allows you to continue the curiosity, continue the learning, continuing the networking that you then bring back into both your life and your business. And then lastly, one of the things I would give a lot of credit to is when you reach and you're running your own company, who's holding you accountable? At the end of the day, if you're the CEO, who's kind of challenging you? And so I got involved in a CEO coaching group. And there are several of them out there. Vistage is the one I happened to land with. And it puts me together with 18 CEOs in a whole range of businesses once a month, and then with a coach, and we do just that. You talk about
accountable.
Yeah, and then hold you accountable. Okay, give us your issue. We're going to give you input. You tell us what you're going to do, and then you report back on what you did and what the results were.
And what's the name of your group that you
believe? Vistage. Yeah, it's Vistage, V-I-S-T-A-G-E, and that has given me, they're probably very responsible for my success. When I look back, I've been in it about 16 years, and I would say they are. Wow. Mostly. Yeah. Yeah.
This podcast is not sponsored by them.
But when you think about it, right? Because we're up here. If you're privately held, you don't have a board of directors per se. They might be family members or something. They're not going to necessarily hold you accountable. So for that group to kind of say, okay, you identified a problem. We're going to give you ideas of how to fix it. You decide how you're going to do it, but then come back and tell us what you did. Don't come back and tell us you still have the problem.
That's great.
Yeah.
So you're also a managing partner of two association management companies, one in Africa and one in India. Can you tell us a little bit about those ventures?
Yeah. So India has actually kind of fallen through. We've had challenging kind of developing the partnership model that we need there. So India. So it's really Africa. Okay. That is the focus. And we launched that company now about 6 years ago. And really designed to do not just what we do here in the US, so provide association management services to African associations at the national, regional, and Pan-African level, and they're managing their events, but also help anybody looking to come onto the African continent. So international associations that might want to come on to the international to the African continent, help them understand what's going on the ground. Build a strategy for how they could look at joining and coming onto the African continent. So those are our primary markets. And then lastly, identifying gaps and starting new associations where we see an opportunity, new associations or new events. So it's been fascinating as doing business in any other part of the world is, but it's been really, really fun. And one of the things that I think has come out of this where it's been the most interesting for me is on a pro bono basis, we launched the African Society of Association Executives and really designed to mirror ASAE, but in Africa, nothing like that existed. And in many cases, the association executives didn't know they were part of a global profession, let alone had connections in their own countries the way we do in the American Association community. So we do development seminars and training seminars in countries all around Africa. And in many cases, these are the first times these executives have been in the room with each other.
Wow.
And it's fascinating. It is just so, and then you just watch it all happen. Because just by virtue of them being together and building a network, you know, my mantra is you don't need me coming in to give you the answer. The answer is here in this room. From your fellow peers. They've all dealt with the same issues. They've all tried to solve many of the same problems. They have a wealth of knowledge that you can now tap into. So just by building this network, our goal is to help the associations become more effective and then start advocating for what they're trying to do better and jointly at a national, regional, and Pan-African level. Because I believe in the power of associations and business events to do the transformational change that Africa is committing to doing and has to do for its people, both economically and on a social level. So associations are a vital part of that. And the more they're capacitated, the more they are able to perform, the better they can help make that happen.
Wow, that must be so rewarding.
It is really special. Yeah.
So you're truly a global organization. Do you find it challenging to build and nurture a team that is global?
You know, I don't know that challenging is the word. I see it as enlightening to everybody because you're expanding people's vision. You're expanding their kind of understanding of the world as you do this. And that is expanding tolerance. That's expanding because you have to listen differently, in many cases, much more intently, as we all know from friends and colleagues who have accents. You have to engage kind of more fully, but that also creates the opportunity to learn to a greater depth. And I think, so that's what we try and promote. That's what we try. And again, when we did our, you know, all hands meeting, gang flies over from Africa so that they can interact and get to know and build the network within just our own company from that standpoint. So, and I went to school for international relations. So I'm really living out my kind of what I wanted to be and do.
Well, that's great. Well, those were all the questions I had, but we always end our podcasts by asking who should be our next guest on this podcast and should be one of the questions we ask.
Great. So I would definitely give you a couple of contacts in Africa, just because I think that perspective is so important in terms of what's happening there. And I think to make it really interesting, I could give you an association executive to speak with, and then I'd want to give you kind of a destination to speak with. That is, you know, what their perspective is. So one I would think about right off the bat would be Frank, and I'll get you his last name, who's the number two in the Rwanda Convention Bureau, which is a story unto itself that in 7 years has gone from nothing to a business event powerhouse in Africa.
Well, that would be great.
Yeah, so I think that'd be really cool. And then just an African association exec to kind of see their perspective about it from their view.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, happy to do that.
Follow up on that. Well, it's always such a pleasure. You're so enlightening, and I really do appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Always love talking about, well, we all love talking about ourselves, but I love talking about this industry that's really been a part of my life for most of my life.
Well, thank you again.
Take care. Good to see you.